people just kind of automatically do knee-jerk reactions about what BABIP means for a player. And obviously this, a lot deeper studies on this have been done than what I wrote for this, but I do think that people need a refresher about how to look at this when you're assessing rest of the season performance or guys to trade or to trade for. I don't think that people realize that the nuances that go behind BABIP are pretty, you know, significant.
Welcome to episode 58 of Flags Fly Forever, a baseball prospectus podcast. You're listening to me, Mike Gianella, because our co-host, Brett Sayre, is away this week. But good news for you, we have an excellent guest co-host joining us alongside George Bissell, our producer, Tim Heaney of USA Today Sports. Tim, I'm thrilled to have you here. I've talked to you for years at Tout Wars, and it's great to have you as a co-host on the show.
Hi, Mike. Hi, George. It's a pleasure to be on, man. It's, you know, thank you for inviting me. I've always, you know, wanted to have more conversations with you that are not Twitter or not the 20 minutes between meeting other people at Tout Wars with a beer. You know, this is a nice, you know, it's good to finally, you know, not feel like we have to squeeze in our life stories in like, you know, 10 minutes again. So,
yeah, and you know, I think the other aspect of Tout is, and George, I know you haven't been there, but it seems like a lot of fun, but when you're in that auction mindset, Tim does the mixed auction. I do the NL auction. You're definitely in a fog where you're like, yeah, I gotta get my game face on because I'm playing against some really tough people.
Yeah, I'm sure the last thing you want to do is just be having conversations. You're probably focused on the strategy aspect of things. But yeah, Tim and I go way back, and it's good to have you on the show, Tim.
Yeah, George. I mean, we've been in a lot of USA Today mock drafts and magazine work together, and always good to, you know, cross mediums with other other avenues. So, you know, this it's a good group we got going tonight, definitely.
Absolutely.
George, how old are you? Like, how far back can you possibly go with anybody?
Well, a couple of years. Most of the stuff was on the football side of things with Tim and Steve Gardner as well. So this is a couple of years ago now, but. Yeah, no, I've been following Tim's work forever, and he does an outstanding job over there at USA Today. Everybody should go follow all his work.
Oh, thanks, guys. Appreciate that. You guys are, you know, that's why I said we have a good group tonight, so I'm happy to be talking with other people that are excellent as well. So,
all right, well, let's jump right into it. We do typically, we're going to do this week as well, and with a little bit of a wrinkle. We're going to talk about the FAB bidding in the expert leagues. And our, you know, I don't really need to explain FAB. Every Tuesday, I do a FAB review column. I often throw some humor in there. This week was kind of surprisingly dry. I didn't really have a lot of funny things to say. Labor mixed, it was obviously the big guys there. Carlos Correa, who went for $51 to Fred Zinke of MLB.com, and Byron Buxton, who went for $41 to Bobby Colton of RotoWire. Now, one thing to kind of start with here, and just to explain to our listeners, I explain this in the columns, Tim is in the Tout Mix auction. There's two Tout Mix leagues. One's an auction, one's a draft. Both are 15-team leagues like Labor. Both have six-man reserve lists. Both, I believe, have limited disabled lists. The one big difference in Tout is you can stash guys like Correa and Buxton while they're still in the minors. You can't do that in Labor. You can do that at the draft when we convene in February. But obviously, if you throw a lot on Correa in mid-February and the Labor doesn't come up, you could be wasting a slot. So, you know, obviously, and I'm going to throw this first to you, Tim, you know, the big bids here, I mean, I think they're appropriate just because it's a mixed league. Nobody's coming over from the other side of the pond, from the AL or the NL. But do you think these bids are appropriate as well?
Oh, yeah, definitely. These are two of the guys that you're going to want to spend, you know, that type of a FAB commitment on. These are the guys that the big names, they do make that big you know, that big impact more so than most other prospects. And at this point in the season, you know, you're 2 months in. If you have, you know, $40, $50 like these guys did have, this is what you've kind of been saving it for. And, you know, like, and like you said, labor, you have to wait on these guys if you didn't roster them, which I'm surprised that Buxton wasn't rostered in this league. But I get it because, you know, it's the kind of a stricter rules in labor, as Steve likes to crack the whip a bit more than the guys at Tout.
Well, keep in mind with Buxton, I mean, I think I agree, although, you know, it's really funny. We had our staff, you know, we worked on the futures guide and we had put a top 50 list together. And I had Buxton, you know, and this again was like a prospect list just for 2015. I think I had Buxton somewhere in the 20s. And the staff kind of, which is funny because it's a dynasty prospect-oriented staff. I might know the least about prospects of any of us. They wanted me to push him down because they said, well, you know, with all the injuries that he's had, with everything else, you know, the timetable could definitely get pushed back. And my argument was like, well, talent has a way of kind of bubbling to the surface and forcing the issue. And I think that's what happened with Buxton. There's still some holes in his game. I get that. But he is the real deal. And I think the Twins, and I agree, you know, they decided he could contribute now.
Yeah, and the path for center field wasn't as clogged as people think. I mean, what was standing his way? Aaron Hicks, Jordan Schaefer, guys that are not exactly stalwart options that are going to say, no, you have to wait. You know, you're not going to play regardless of how good you are. And obviously those two guys had their flaws. And Eddie Rosario kind of threw a wrench into that by coming up sooner too. But, you know, they, like you said, it just kind of, you know, doors open and, you know, Buxton came back up. So it's funny because Buxton, I think people overrated how much power he was going to have initially. I don't think that he was a guy that's going to be, you know, immediately chipping away at what his upside could be. I think there's more of a steals batting average, but, you know, Starling Marte-ish type of power, a little bit too many grounders, but, you know, good enough power when he does connect on something like that, where he'll get 10 home runs, I think, over a full season in his first full major league season, something like that.
Yeah, we don't like comps, but I have to say that that's, I like the Marte comp. I didn't even think of that, but yeah, 30, 35 steals at the beginning, 10 home runs seems like a ceiling, and that might be generous. But yeah, I think Buxton in a deep mix league with the runs and stolen bases alone, well, I think he's worth it in a standard mix, although he's more of a back end outfielder there right now in a non keeper. But yeah, without a doubt, you know, and going back to the bids for a second, you know, Fred Zinke's in third place and, you know, this is a pretty big move for him. Steve Gardner missed out on both of these players by just a little bit. It's not listed in the Masters Ball link I sent you, but Steve had one of the big bids on Buxton. He bid 41. I think it was transposed here by accident in the article. So he tied on Buxton, and he lost out on a dollar to Correa. So Steve, who's 2 points ahead of us in labor mix for first place as we talk about this, he made the right move as well. He went big. Our bids were relatively conservative. We had 36 left to spend. We bid 32 each on Correa and Buxton in that order. One of the reasons that we spent conservatively, we put a big bid on Jason Grilly, which our listeners know, but you probably don't, Tim, because you probably don't avidly follow all of the other expert leagues. I certainly don't. Because we started out with Jenry Mejia as our closer and our only closer, and we need to get aggressive with saves. So I think to your point, there's ways to get aggressive with FAB. Saves is definitely a good way to do it early if you're short on saves, particularly in a mixed league. I don't like dumping categories. I think in an only you can do it, in a mix, I don't think you should. So that was kind of our play there. So, you know, we've been aggressively for what we had, but we just weren't quite able to grab those guys.
Yeah, and it's funny because you had to kind of, you know, prioritize which one you actually wanted. And I do think Correa probably deserved a bit more just because of that shortstop advantage that he gave. And the shortstop class this year, as we know, is just so erratic, up and down. And, you know, that's a guy that, you know, he, for his age, his batting eye is even more just as impressive to me as our, as you know, his natural raw power skills. He's a big boy, Correa. He's got a lot going for him there.
Yeah,
he's already up to 3 home runs in like 36 plate appearances already. 3 home runs. But Tim, I'd be really interested to get your thoughts on whether or not going forward you would change sort of your FAB strategy, seeing the impact that these prospects have had and just the sheer number that have come up this year. You know, looking ahead to future years, are you going to be shifting your strategy more towards saving that fab early in the year and maybe avoiding some of the bids like what Mike was talking about with a closer bid on a guy like a Jason Grilley who crops up in the opening week? Are you going to sort of change your strategy based on what's happened this year with all the prospects coming up?
I don't think it's healthy to go year to year in terms of like how you want to map out an overall fab strategy, because this year we talk about how prospects make an impact more recently than ever, but this year it just seems like it was a perfect storm of guys at the right age, the right experience before this year that were ready to make that jump. You know, the Correa, the Bucks, and the Bryant, you know, the guys that were just really knocking at the door for at least more than, you know, half a season that really were, you know, primed to come up this year. And it's funny because teams didn't waste much time doing it. They didn't wait till the Super 2, you know, hard deadline or whatever. I don't want to assume that next year's class is going to be this much of an impact, because these guys are going to, you know, these guys will be filling the spots that they took. And, you know what I'm saying? It's kind of like you don't want to assume spots will be there for the next wave that they were for this class. And then you don't want to assume that they'll be far enough along next year as they will be as this class. This class is very much seems like very much polished players in comparison to the bigger groups that we've seen. So, yeah, I want to, you know, I don't want to just kind of put myself in a box right now. I want to, you know, you take a look at the player pool next year and see where the vulnerabilities are, see what the minor league class looks like. And, you know, you don't want to say that much about future years based on this current sample size.
Yeah, absolutely. It's looking like kind of an outlier year on the whole with the prospects.
And Tim, you kind of nailed the point. Like I often, not just with this, I often see people look. You know, I was talking to a friend of BP, contributes a little bit to BP Wrigleyville. He also has his own site at Bleacher Nation. You know, I was talking on Twitter to our friend Brett Taylor, and you know, he made the point. He said, wow, you know, this could be a sea change for prospects, and they're doing so much right off the bat. And it's like, you know, this is all cyclical. You know, a couple of years ago, it was like all the pitchers are doing everything and the hitters are doing nothing. I think you have to be really careful making statements like this. I mean, it could be the start of something. I just think that if it is, we don't have enough data right now. We're kind of looking at 2 months of rookies and not even half a season. So I think we kind of need to take a step back and, you know, before we kind of jump to that conclusion. At the very least, we need more data. But I agree with all those points, Tim. So to kind of move on, and we don't normally talk about this league, but you're in it and you're our guest, so I think it's the polite thing to do. Let's talk a little bit about Tout Mixed and the AL. Mm-hmm. So you had some bids there, and you did have a bid actually on Buxton, who it looks like he wasn't taken. And your bid was pretty conservative. It looks like you bid 14, if I'm reading correctly.
Yeah, I only had 17 left because I was pretty aggressive. So yeah, I had to put at least something out there. You didn't want to just put nothing and assume, you know, but definitely just want to get in the fray a little bit there.
So the guy, and so Buxton over on that side of the house, he went for 46. Now, as our listeners know, there's a Vickery bidding system in Tout. And so Patrick Davitt, who unfortunately I'm off the top of my head, I don't know his affiliation because we normally don't talk about this league, and I try to mention it.
Baseball HQ is with Mike.
He's with HQ. Okay, he's like the one person from HQ I like haven't met. So Patrick Davitt, well, most of them are on the East Coast, and I went to one of their first pitch events to speak. I think it was in March, so I met most of them. I didn't meet Patrick. But looks like he got him for 46. David Ganos fell a dollar short or was the next bit at 45. So I think it's kind of the same principle over there. And I think in Tout with, you know, the extra fab you can get from, you know, reclaiming guys or that go on the DL, I think they added that rule this year. That's a perfectly sensible bid to me for Buxton and a perfectly acceptable risk.
Yeah, I'm kicking myself because he's actually been a free agent for a few weeks. He was actually owned by someone and he was dropped a couple weeks ago. I saw him there. I just never kind of had the inclination to go a little bit more on him or make him a priority bid because I've had more immediate needs to cover. But it's funny because in this league, they expanded the bench spots from 4 last year to 6 this year. And that's very friendly for stashing players. And that's something that I probably should have taken a little bit more advantage of with Buxton. Because, you know, like you said, that's the way unlike in labor, there's a little bit more maneuverability with picking up minor league players in this league. And the extra roster space definitely, you know, should push you normally towards thinking ahead, and that's a case where I was very surprised Buxton lasted this long as a free agent.
I mean, I will say though, getting back to the cyclical nature, I mean, I've been in town at NL since 2010, and there's some years where it works. You know, I think last year I stashed like Matt Whistler, who never came up for the Padres, and I mean, the one funny thing is I stashed Chris Bryant. And that didn't work, but the nice thing about it is I think Gene McCaffrey of Wise Guy Baseball thought he was going to come up. So I traded Bryant for like $50 Fab to have the Fab hammer at the deadline. And, you know, the thing that stunk is I needed pitching, and I think it was like, oh, John Lackey and Justin Masterson came in, and I was kind of hoping that David Price and John Lester would come in. You know, that was really, really the hope, and it didn't happen. So, yeah, there's a lot of mechanics and tout wars with the Fab and with the league that I think are really interesting. And, you know, labor is certainly challenging too, but I think it's a more traditional league in terms of the angles, whereas tout is definitely kind of the innovators league. And, you know, I mean, like Vickery, for example, I don't know anybody personally who plays in a Vickery league.
It's an interesting change, and I think it throws off the interesting you know, bidding styles, and people take more risks because they figure, you know, it'll be knocked down anyway unless someone else really feels as strongly about a player. So it's interesting that when people get stuck with, you know, $16 bids on people that they really didn't want, that type of thing, and it's fun to take those risks, but it's not good if you are on the bad end of one of those.
Now, I did really like who you got as speaking of stashing somebody, I really dig who you got as a backup for Buxton. It looks like you got Hector Oliveira, if I'm reading this correctly.
It went down for $1, yes. So that was, you know, that was a pleasant, you know, surprise that no one else even, I don't think anyone else even threw a bid on him. So
yeah, I mean, he's been in the top 25 on Baseball Prospectus' stash list for some time, and it really seems that he will be up with the Dodgers at some point. Now, you know, granted, the Dodgers have a crowded offense. Maybe he won't be a full-timer, which, you know, in a 15-team mix is certainly more of an issue than an NL only. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for a dollar, it's kind of like, well, injuries can happen. He could certainly, you know, push the envelope for playing time. I really like that as a stash, particularly with the six-man reserve stim.
Oh, thanks. And yeah, I do think that he's speeding along right now. The Dodgers really seem inclined to get him somewhere in that rotation. And I have Justin Turner as a backup, so that's kind of a thing where I'm thinking maybe I handcuff those at-bats a little bit just to plug those around the infield if Turner turns into a bit more of a pumpkin, as he has been a little bit lately. At least the pace has gone down. So, you know, that's another case where I guess, you know, that could work out if that stash actually sticks.
Yeah, and with the liberal, like, reserve active rules, I mean, you can always kind of look for opportunities in terms of interleague play, in terms of platoons, in terms of what the Dodgers are doing in terms of tendencies to kind of roll him in and out. You know, mixed leagues do often have one or two slots, even in a mix at the back end of the offense, that tend to be a little bit softer than, say, in a 12-team mix, without a doubt.
Yeah, nice to play the matchups, that sort of thing, and, you know, play schedules, you know. It gives you nice little ways to experiment that other leagues might not.
Now, in your other bidding block, and I'm kind of interested about this because this is the other player I wanted to ask you about. Mm. You did bid on Vincent Velasquez, but you had a first of all, he wasn't even your first choice, and second of all, it looks like you had a $2 bid on him, and he went for, what do you go for, 10 or 11? He went for 10. The high bid was 11. Vickery brought him down to 10. So it seems to me that you guys were pretty cool on Velasquez. Do you think that there's a reason for that? Do you think that there's a feeling that, you know, Velasquez won't be up long, or that, you know, he's one of those pitchers who might look good a couple times, but there's some volatility with him?
Yeah, I think it's more so, you know, I'm in the pitcher categories in town. I think I'm either like second or first in ERA, WHIP, strikeouts, and wins. I'm pretty, you know, high up for each of those categories. I like Velasquez's, his stuff is pretty sick when you watch it live. I mean, his fastball's, you know, it threatens triple digits if not touches it. But, you know, that's also a case where I do think that the walks he's shown so far are going to keep biting him for most of the year, even though his control's been pretty good. You know, at the higher levels, he hasn't had much time at the higher levels, so that's not really the sample size that I want to see for the control being stable. So I like him. I like the talent. I like the way Houston's developing their pitchers, but the guys I bid on ahead of him were Evan Scribner and Ivan Nova, who's coming back from Tommy John at some point in the next week or two. I'm weak and safe, so Evan Scribner's a guy that I want to take a chance on because Tyler Clippard trade rumors have been popping up and Oakland selling, you know, and Sean Doolittle being hurt. that was kind of a chance where I figured that it would be good for me to go on. But obviously, someone else felt the same way. I didn't get him. So,
I was going to say, it looks like you got Nova, right?
I did. Not my favorite. I mean, but his velocity looks good after Tommy John. You know, the rehab going on, just needs to work on the braking stuff. So I'm a big Nova guy myself. I think the 2014 sample was off. I think the years before that were more logical. But yeah, Velasquez would have been cool. He would have been like, you know, my number seven starter or something like that. No expectations, but you know, I think either one of these guys would have been fine to have.
Yeah, and again, I think this is kind of our experience in labor. I think some people think mixed and they think, oh, like, why are you bidding on some of these guys? They're scrubs. They're for 20-team dynasty or only. But, again, the six-man reserve and the unlimited disabled list makes a difference. I think their free agent pool is a lot weaker than people who don't play in these formats realize.
And especially with the more added reserve spots this year, it's definitely more of a trading and overbidding type of thing. I've been finding myself trading a lot more this year than I have just, you know, because everyone's, you know, tucking away these guys and hoarding them.
Yeah, speaking of that, you made a big trade this week in TalentMix, and I want to talk about that. Just let our listeners know, we're going to keep the NL and the AL really short and sweet this week because there's not really a lot there that was all that interesting. So what was the trade that you made this week, Tim?
I made a trade with Corey Schwartz of MLB.com. The main category I'm weak in this league is power and home runs, so... Gene Segura is a guy that I was big on this year coming in, just, you know, the middle infield speed advantage. However, you know, getting Billy Hamilton a couple weeks ago for Dexter Fowler really covered that speed need for me for a while. So I figured that Corey needed a little bit more speed. I needed more power. So we started off trading Chris Carter for Gene Segura, but then he sent me Jason Hayward and Danny Espinosa for my Will Venable and my Michael Franco. So kind of, you know, a little bit of retooling, but you know, it's it kind of evens out with the priorities that we need. You know, the bodies are there, covers all three spots, but I wanted the more, you know, difference making power with Carter. I thought Franco could have done that, but I also wanted to try out Hayward and see if the extreme regression is there. So interesting deal. It's going to be one that makes or breaks my season, I think.
I like the play on Hayward there as well. I mean, he kind of always, I know he's slumped most of the year, and you know, right now he's been in the eighth slot quite a bit in that lineup, which doesn't help him particularly from a runs perspective. But I like him as a bounce back candidate. I think Franco at some point is going to kind of go through those first year, you know, lumps. It's honestly a little surprising he's come out of the gate as well as he's done, because his MO usually is to struggle at every level.
Yeah, and you know, he's just a hacker, and I mean, I'm getting a hacker back in Carter, but he's an OBP guy more than a BA guy. Along with that potential for 20 home runs the rest of the season, I couldn't pass up that chance.
Yeah, so I'm going to shift to the National League in Tout. Tim, you play in the Labor AL, so I'll just kind of go over, you know, what I did in Tout, and it was actually very little. So there were two players who went for over 10 this week. Both Reds. One of them was Eugenio Suarez, who went for 17 to Phil Hertz of Baseball HQ. He bid 28. Steve Gardner of USA Today bid 16. Then the other player was Ivan De Jesus Jr. He went to Gene McCaffrey of Wise Guy Baseball for 12, bid 17. Steve, once again, who I think had the backup bid in every single league he's in, bid 11.
He's smart like that. He's smart.
Yeah, I bid very conservatively on these guys, and George has heard me talk about this. I bid one on Suarez and zero on De Jesus. There's a couple reasons for this. One is my offense is very strong, and I mean, two is I'm in first place and I have the most fab. I'm not sure if that can last. You know, speaking of regression, I have Clayton Kershaw, so what I'm hoping is that my pitching, which has been a little bit above average, can be more than that with Kershaw, you know, pitching like Kershaw as he started to do. So really my strategy at this point is kind of to wait until the deadline or close to the deadline and try to nab the big hitter coming or the big pitcher coming in from the AL and kind of see how that plays out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's if you're sitting in the, you know, the bird's nest or cat's nest like you are, that's you know, that why not at this point, if you're covered in most places. I do think that Cincinnati situation is going to be weird, depending a lot, you know, on Phillips' health was kind of affected for a little while there, and that's why these guys kind of got a lot of those at-bats they did, and Marlon Byrd might be coming back a lot sooner than expected. So, yeah, it's going to be an interesting toss-up to see what happens there. You know, Suarez is the guy that kind of seems like the better shortstop that could fill in for Cozart for the longer period. DeJesus is the better bat, but where is he going to play? You got Chris Negron doing a lot of the things that he does. So it's do you want to, do you want the secure at bats, or do you want to take the chance and get a bigger break out of that? It's definitely I would be with you. I probably wouldn't be that aggressive on that whole situation, but you know, if you land one of them for cheap, then sure. You know.
The problem, I think, the problem is, and you know, particularly like I talked to Phil, you know, via email after I posted the article, and you know, Phil made a couple points. You know, this is always the stuff that you don't really get in the article, and you kind of get on the podcast or behind the scenes. He had Zach Cozart, so
right. I was just gonna say, yeah, that makes sense.
Need, but the other thing, Phil actually has only 28 left in FAB. He bid 28, so he bid his full amount on Suarez, you know. And I asked him what his thinking was. I said, "Well, you knew Vickery's going to bring that down, but you know, if somebody bid 20 behind you, you know, it leaves you with seven." He has David Wright and Ryan Zimmerman, so his thinking is kind of like, "Well, if those guys come back, great. That's a huge boost. If they don't, I'm going to reclaim the FAB." And the final point is, Phil is a master at trading for and trading FAB. That's another thing you do in tout. He does that a lot. So, you know, he's not going to be – even if he went to zero, he wouldn't be there for long. He's just the kind of guy who will flip until he gets that money back.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, the tout flexibility with those adjustments, you're allowed to be a little more creative with your process. So that makes sense.
The only other point I'll make in tout about it – and I didn't put him on the agenda, Tim. I'm sorry. Just because he had a big night tonight. I'm kicking myself on this one. Kyle Schwarber went for $1 to Tristan Cockcroft. Nobody else.
Oh, wow.
And – you know, Cubs Twitter, if you're listening, and I hope some of you are, I follow, and you guys follow me, I like 100 of you. And you all were mentioning Schwarber, and you all were saying he might be up. And again, this is NL only versus mixed. I think in a 15-team mix, maybe you don't add Schwarber if he's going to be up for a week.
Yeah.
I mean, I have Jose Lobaton as my second catcher. So adding Schwarber for a buck, and just even if he wasn't, you know, doing anything, and then stashing him would have been a worthy move. You know, Tristan always seems – we're always like, why does Tristan win three – you know, why has he won tout three times in a row? Well, it's because he's good. Because he's on top of these situations and because he knows what he's doing. So, you know, Tristan, you know, hats off to you if you're listening for a really good move. And, you know, hopefully – you know, we say this every week, and I think George is getting tired of hearing this. So Tristan right now is 11 points behind me, tied for fourth. I mean, with all due respect to Lenny Melnick and Derek Carty, who are sitting between us, I worry at least as much about Tristan as I do about those teams because, like I said, he's good and he finds a way to compete like every freaking year.
A lot of time left in the season. Plenty
of
time left.
Well, that too. If you want, you know, if you want to do something sobering, and you know, I'm going to plug something I normally don't plug. So you can, if you go to the toutwars.com website, this is kind of where you can follow the standings. And the stat service is on Roto, which I use for my home league. It's a great stat service. One of the things you can do is you can look at past year's results. If you want to do something sobering, go back and look at the mid-June results for the last few years in tout. I think Tristan 2 years ago was the only team that was in first in mid-June and won. So, you know, hopefully that's not a jinx for me and hopefully things hold. But yeah, we're, you know, this is why I'm not bragging about being in first. It's more like, hey, it's better to be in first than be in last. But, you know, we know it's a long season and a lot can happen between, you know, now and the end of the year, without a doubt.
Yeah.
In case you're counting at home, 3 hits and a triple tonight so far for Schwarber.
Okay, but he didn't hit a homer, though, did he?
Not yet.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is the guy that Tristan dropped for Schwarber was Austin Hedges, who did hit a homer. So, I mean, obviously, still a good move, but it's just funny how that works out sometimes.
Yeah.
So moving to the AL, and again, we're going to mix it up a little bit because of our guest. Labor AL. Now, Labor AL was kind of quiet, and I think some of this, again, goes back to the rules and no Vickery, and you can't speculate, which really makes for a very limited free agent pool in an only. I don't think you didn't actually bid on anybody this week, did you, Tim?
I bid on Velasquez only for like $8 because I only have 40-something left. I've been building up playing time as we've come along.
You bid one on Matt Andrezi, who went for 5 NFBC, which I think is...
it's Sean and Greg.
It's Sean and Greg. Yep. Yeah, Sean Childs and Greg Ambrosius. And I think Andrezi had a great outing tonight, or he was having a great outing the last time I checked.
Yeah, I previously owned him too. I had to drop him for to make room for guys that came up. So sadly, you know, he's one of those guys that he can, you know, a swing man in these leagues are kind of, you know, important to have if they can do it properly, like a Steven Geltz or an Andreas type. So
I should also, you know, we don't talk much about labor only. You know, I said it's traditional. Another difference, the only leagues are really intriguing in terms of differences, because in tout, you can reserve anybody. I mean, you can reserve a guy in the minors. Well, you can't reserve a guy in the other league if you're an only, but you can reserve a guy in the minors. You can reserve anyone, you know, minors, majors, whatever. In labor, the only guys that you can move back and forth are the guys that you draft on reserve at the beginning of the season. Which is a very, and that's still correct, right, Tim?
And guys that are currently in the minors, you can send down too.
Right, but yeah, saying is you can't. Thanks for clarifying. But
yeah, no problem.
You can't like take a guy like Andrisi, for example, if he's in the majors, and decide, well, I'm going to start him this week because, you know, he's facing the White Sox and, you know, they haven't hit in a month. Versus saying, well, he's going to Yankee Stadium. I'm going to put him on my bench and see what happens. So.
Yep.
That kind of changes the philosophy a little bit there. You can't really do what you're, you know, going to do otherwise.
You can't just fling stuff at the wall as much in labor. That's definitely a you got to be confident in who you want to play and who you want to sign.
Yeah, especially with those pitchers, without a doubt.
Yeah, totally.
So the big guy in labor, and, you know, this is going to be the Vincent Velasquez show.
Right.
22 to Fangraphs, and is that Eno over there, Eno Saris?
Correct. Yeah.
And, you know, Masters Ball, you know, just kind of missed at 21. I think it only, and we kind of talked about this, I think, a little bit with Eduardo Rodriguez, who I think in tout went for 37. That seems appropriate for Velasquez. Maybe he should have gone for a little bit more. But I think that's pretty close to appropriate me for, you know, for the points that you made before we talked about Velasquez. He's got a high ceiling. I've kind of compared him a little bit to Noah Syndergaard in terms of, like, that velocity and being a two-pitch guy whose third pitch still needs work. You know, I think Syndergaard's obviously better. You know, the other thing is Syndergaard doesn't have that walk volatility that Velasquez most certainly does.
Right. And in labor AL, Eduardo Rodriguez a couple weeks ago went for 54. But there was a lot... Right, there's a lot more security with his role, I think, and with that talent too. So,
well, it's funny you say that, because that was our discussion around Rodriguez, was that we were surprised he only went for 37.
Yeah.
You know, we thought like 50 or so was kind of the appropriate number, and we were really shocked that, you know, he went for such a little amount, that somebody with Vickery, you know, didn't just put the hammer down and say, you know what, I'm going to go crazy and I'm going to bid like 55 to 60 and, you know, hopefully just get him for like 45 or 40.
Yeah, and, you know, the Red Sox staff definitely, you know, could use him for the long haul. So, I mean, you always have to consider, you know, the openings that these guys are going to have, as we talked about before. And Rodriguez definitely had a clear one. So,
yeah. So I think that's going to wrap up our Fab talk. As always, you know, this is kind of if you play in Fab leagues, that was an interesting discussion. If you don't, you know, I'm kind of sorry, although I will say that it helps me out. Even in leagues where I do waiver claims, just kind of get a feel for what other people think guys are worth. And it honestly kind of helps me with trade talk to kind of look at a guy, you know, and say, well, you know, at least when they're picked up, this is kind of the pecking order of what people think. So we're going to shift gears. And, you know, we normally do a second topic and normally Brett or I pick it. But since Tim's our guest, you know, I'm actually going to throw it to Tim for an article that he put up today at USA Today. I believe it's at USA Today, right, Tim?
Correct, and it's also will be in this current edition of Sports Weekly. So,
well, that's great. So
you can find it there,
weekly as well, which you can find on your newsstands. I think your Barnes and Nobles. I don't know if my supermarket still carries it, but you can still find it in a lot of places.
7-Elevens usually have them, and it'll be the full version there too. This is the abridged one we post online too.
Oh, so. Okay,
yeah.
So I'm going to use the dreaded reporter question. Tell me about the article, Tim. Tell me about what you wrote about it. It's an article about BABIP. I really liked it because I think BABIP often gets written about in a very basic way and kind of tells us, you know, the obvious, which is if a guy has a really high BABIP, you know, it's a fluke. If a guy has a really low BABIP, unless it's a, you know, high strikeout guy with weak contact, it's a fluke. But without going into a super deep dive, just tell me a little bit about, you know, what the thrust of the piece was.
Mike, these pointed questions, man. I'm gonna walk off if you keep trying to dig this much with these hard nosed, you know, ways you're asking these things. I think you kind of hit what I was going for with this article, that people just kind of automatically do knee-jerk reactions about what BABIP means for a player. And obviously, this a lot deeper studies on this have been done than what I wrote for this. But I do think that people need a refresher about how to look at this when you're assessing rest of the season performance or guys to trade or to trade for. I don't think that people realize that the nuances that go behind BABIP are pretty, you know, significant. The talk that most researchers found, you know, that I've read at Baseball HQ, Fangraphs, ESPN, you guys, obviously, is that, you know, the typical league average for BABIP sits around 300. And the common conception is that people kind of, you know, hitters and pitchers kind of move towards that as the season goes on. I think that's a bit of a short-sighted answer, because most players do keep trends about what they do over their careers, or they change if they have a significant change to their game. And, you know, like you said, the three big things that do affect it are batted ball dispersion, contact percentage, and hard contact percentage, which is finally becoming a bit more of a common statistic now that more sites are carrying it. So you kind of have to always look at the context around what a player's bat, how it fits with his profile as a hitter or a pitcher, and what's been shown and what you think is going to come, because you shouldn't care about what's been shown, at least for the rest of the season, but you can look at it as a foundation of what's to come based on current trends and indicators.
Now, you know, I know we talk about this at Baseball Prospectus, and I think that, you know, we've had a couple of our authors, and I think it's Russell Carlton now who does this for us, that there is, and I don't know if you touched on the article or not, there is a point in the season where numbers kind of normalize. Where would you say that BABIP, like within a season in terms of plate appearances, normalizes?
I mean, I've read differing figures on this. I don't want to speak for the, you know, I'm not the most, you know, by the number statistical, this is what it means type of guy. But I think, you know, around mid-May, you kind of starting to see, okay, maybe something's starting to mean something. And then now, if it's been verified, then you say, uh-oh, this could be this could be the real thing here, especially if guys are hitting, you know, say a guy's hitting a lot of line drives right now. And, you know, the common conception is that, you know, the batted ball or a pitched ball can't be controlled much. But, you know, a player's current form does play a lot into what happens to a ball. I think, you know, more line drives, more hard contact, that's and more fly balls, more ground balls, more line drives, that sort of thing. And I think at this point we could say, all right, if this player's numbers don't jive, it's going to kind of flip on its head. But if, you know, a guy's, you know, has a BABIP of like 370, but he's, you know, hitting 26% line drive, something like that, that's you know, that's a good correlation, not necessarily causation, but definitely a correlation of performance that you can kind of say, okay, this is not that much of a fluke, but, you know, it'll calm down, but it's still kind of, we'll keep that same theme going.
George, I've kind of, and in general, I apologize. I think when Brett's here, we're a little bit better about kind of looping you in, but.
Oh, how, sorry.
How do you use BABIP? Like, how, in your leagues, like, how do you kind of tend to look at that?
Well, I think a great example of using BABIP, and a guy who I've owned for a couple of years that I kind of always deal with the BABIP issue with, is Dee Gordon, who Tim actually touched on in the piece. And you look at what he was doing earlier in the year when he was leading the majors in batting average. He was running a preposterously high BABIP. I think it was as high as like 474 at one point, with a 24% infield hit rate. I mean, BABIP, really what you have to do is analyze what's going on in relation to a player's career rates. You know, if a guy's a speedster who's racking up infield hits and he's generating, you know, a high number of ground balls, that's going to translate into a high BABIP. I think we simplify it too much when really what we should be looking for is how a player's current BABIP relates to his career rates.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, you know, the other point too is that, you know, there are some guys, you know, and I think everybody on this, you know, podcast knows this, but there's the hard hit balls are certainly important. Like Joey Votto, I think when he first came up and before we had the hard hit data, people were looking at his BABIP and saying it's going to come down and going to come down. And I always had the instinct with like, well, you know, maybe the average didn't come down a little bit, but this is a guy who's just destroying the ball. You know, this is a guy who, as people say, even his outs are loud. You know, the other factor I always look at are speed guys. You know, I know Tristan, you know, I mentioned before, he did a great, you know, long form on this at ESPN a couple of years ago. You know, he made the point that speed guys, you have to kind of take into account that if they have a lot of ground balls, they might kind of be dribblers, but, you know, they're more likely to kind of beat those out and have a higher BABIP. You know, Ichiro, I think, was kind of like, not that he had a bunch of dribblers, but Ichiro was kind of notorious for having a super high BABIP and it being sustainable.
Yeah, same thing for, like you mentioned, with power hitters. I mean, just look at the way Giancarlo Stanton makes contact. I mean, when he hits a ball hard, it's going. It doesn't matter how slow he's running. Or Miguel Cabrera is another good example of that. Even if he hits a grounder, he's hitting it so hard that the defense doesn't have a chance to make a play on it.
So, Tim, do you have any other takeaways from your article that you kind of wanted to bring up?
Yeah, I mean, I'll touch on the long form a bit, that everything's in there. I mean, you know, Dallas Keuchel obviously is a huge one for pitchers that people are going to say, oh, you know, 235 BABIP, that's going to go back up to 300. You know, people don't realize how much the shift also has affected BABIP on both sides of batting and hitting. Sorry, batting and pitching. Obviously the Astros shift a lot, and that's going to help Keuchel if he does pitch to the shift more frequently. So that's another case where it could, you know, top out about 260, 270, and that's just normal for him. As we said, fly ball hitters are, you know, very much more so to keep, low BABIPs just because, because obviously BABIP doesn't count any home runs. It's all balls in play. So, you know, other fly balls, most of them are going to be outs. Or the stat that people don't look at, infield fly percentage, which is probably the least productive thing you can do when you hit a baseball. So, infield fly ball is a killer for that sort of thing, too. You're not going to have a good BABIP with that. So, yeah, it's just you definitely just have to keep in context of what these guys are doing at this point.
You know, I think what I'm hearing, too, which is, you know, really interesting, and this kind of years ago when BABIP and, you know, on the other side of it, on the pitching side, when FIP came out, there were disciples of these statistics who were like, this tells you everything. And my instinct was always, well, you know what? They're important, and they tell you something. But you have to be careful because, you know, pitchers, for example, with FIP, there are pitchers who just generate weaker contact than, you know, pitchers that don't. And you could kind of see that. And, you know, BABIP's kind of the same way. It's a point you're making, Tim. I think there are hitters who generate stronger contact, you know, than other hitters. And that's something we've kind of moved away from being doctrinaire about BABIP. And saying, you know, if this is the guy's BABIP and this is his average, you know, it should go down or it should go up. And I think that's a really good thing, you know, in terms of analysis. And I think we've kind of, you know, if anything, what's really funny is that, and this is particularly true with FIP, you know, years ago I was kind of saying, you know, don't pay too much attention, don't overemphasize FIP. And, you know, now we've almost moved the other way where people are like, FIP's worthless. And I'm like, well, you know, there's still some uses to it. It just, you know, you've almost gone too far in the other direction. I don't think we're there with BABIP yet, but, you know, hopefully we don't get to that point where it's disregarded. But your piece definitely was a very well-measured piece, you know, and did a really good job of kind of addressing, you know, the points without doing it, without throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, and I think any type of extreme saying, you know, one stat is the almighty, it's not a good way to play fantasy. It's not a good way to analyze baseball. Obviously, you guys know. You guys piece together stats. You guys, you know, have your components that you definitely put the puzzle together with. And, you know, it's definitely the healthiest way to do it and the most complete way to do it is to say what does the entirety of the picture mean with the macro and the micro. So, you know.
Absolutely.
Makes sense.
All right. Well, I think, unless you have anything else, I think we're going to, you know, kind of close out the subject and close out the show. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back with our closing. Once again, thank you for listening to Flags Fly Forever, a baseball prospectus podcast. Just a few reminders. Our daily game with DraftKings.com is going on right now. You can join a game almost every day of the week and beat the experts for a $3 entry. Most of the BP fantasy writers do play, and I have to say it's a lot of fun. Also, the new Baseball Prospectus Fantasy app is out. It's Baseball Prospectus' in-season fantasy guide. There's a lot of good stuff in there, including tiered rankings by position, a daily fantasy primer, the stash list on the fantasy app, and a couple of articles that are really useful for players. We will be updating that during the season, and at some point next month, another edition will be out. Also, if you have any questions for us, please send them to flagsflyforever, all one word, at baseballperspectives.com. Once again, I'd like to thank our guest, Tim Haney of USA Today Sports, for joining us. Tim, thank you so much for coming on the show. And to our listeners, have a great night.
Bye, Tim.
See you guys.